Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa has a rich labor and working class past. Today, what I think will be a fascinating show for all of us, we'll travel back through time on a tour of that history with help from the Iowa Labor History Oral Project. We'll find out what that project's all about in a minute, but we'll hear voices from that project, from past labor activists. And this hour, we have two tour guides into the past, so to speak. John McCurley is with us, oral and public historian at the Iowa Labor Center, located at the University of Iowa. John, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
And Shelton Stromquist is with us, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa. Shelton, welcome back to you.
Very nice to be here.
Before we get into the specifics of this fascinating project, I'd like to have you introduce us to the field of labor history. We have two words we understand there, labor and history, but it's not sort of self-evident what this field covers. Tell us more about it, Shelton.
Well, it's a field that has burgeoned in recent decades, in part because we have access to new kinds of sources, including those of the Iowa Labor History Oral Project, that enable us to get at the experience of ordinary people, of everyday working people, whose work lives, whose organizing, whose building of unions in many cases is really an integral part of the fabric of our state and of the nation, for that matter. But traditionally, that's been an aspect of our history that's been neglected. We've tended to understand our history from the top down, through presidents and through congresses and through leaders. So labor history, particularly in recent decades, has really tried to kind of reconstruct and resurrect a history that is really the fabric of daily life that people live, that your listeners live, that we live, and that unfortunately goes neglected too often.
Right. And the benefits of which this labor movement struggles from previous generations, young people today often don't even realize the work conditions they have are to thank. They have previous generations and this labor history, the prominent figures in it, to thank for those good, we hope, very good working conditions. Right.
Well, there's a bumper sticker that many of your listeners may have seen that says, "The weekend brought to you by the labor movement."
Right. Explain that.
Well,
we didn't always have weekends.
That's right. People worked 7 days a week, worked 12 hours a day or more.
Right.
It was difficult for them to have lives outside of work, of the wage earning that was so necessary to the support of their families and their communities. So there are real benefits that the labor movement has brought. And labor history is very much a part of that story of the building of a labor movement. But it's also more than that. It's also about the nature of people's lives and why they turn to unions in many cases to try to improve.
Okay, we're going to work through the decades here, sort of trace this. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. If you have a story of labor activism, we'd be interested in it, of union work. You'll get the idea as we work through this hour. Keep that number handy, though, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So let's be specific now about this Iowa Labor History Oral Project, ILHOP. Am I pronouncing the acronym correctly, John?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. What is ILHOP?
So ILHOP is a collaboration, a 40-year-old plus collaboration between the Iowa Labor Movement, specifically the Iowa Federation of Labor, the University of Iowa Labor Center, the State Historical Society of Iowa, particularly here in Iowa City, and then most recently, the University of Iowa Libraries and a new nonprofit that's called the Iowa Labor History Society.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's talk a little bit about the founding. You collected some audio that we'll be hearing throughout the hour. James Wengert is a founder of this project. Before we hear his voice, tell us about him and what we're going to hear.
Okay. So Jim Wengert was a Sioux City packing house worker, member of the United Packing House Workers of America, a union that was very important both in Iowa and the Midwest and nationally, that recognized that workers, as we were talking about before, that workers' stories are often lost, right? You know, workers don't tend to write their memoirs, right? Mm-hmm. And so in order to have workers' stories be part of the story, someone had to record them.
Okay, let's hear some words from the founder of the Iowa Oral Labor History Project, the former president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, born in Sioux City, Jim Wengert, describing the goal of the Oral History Project, something that will get the total history of Iowa workers out there.
It was my position and really position of all the AFL-CIO. Maybe there was some jealousy amongst a few. But by and large, the overwhelming support, if we were going to do a history project, then we couldn't look at whether people were affiliated or unaffiliated. We had to say that this was going to be a project that there wasn't going to be any state-fed politics involved in it. That we were going out there and we were going to interview a railroad worker or an auto worker or a teamster and not look at who was affiliated so that we got the total history.
Okay, very interesting. The philosophy there from Jim Wengert that you really want this bottom-up history, right, John?
Right, precisely, precisely, and that's a bottom-up history. But also you can hear him talking there. In the time of the 1970s, you had a much larger labor movement both in Iowa and around the country, and so there are of course internal politics within the labor movement that he was having to negotiate as he created this project. But at the same time, I think it's clear from what we know about Jim's intent for the project was that it was designed to be a project that encapsulated the lives of all Iowa workers and put them at the center of the story.
Right. And he mentioned trying to keep politics out of that. It's hard to imagine in this day and age keeping politics out of a discussion about unions. But that's the intent here. And I think that's feel that's
no,
succeeded?
No, it's very much a project that was designed from the beginning and inspired, as it was, by Jim Wengert's vision to be inclusive. To not leave people out. I can't stress enough, and John would agree, I think, very much, that this is really a unique project because it was literally supported by every union member around the state who, through their per capita dues, a small portion, but every single member contributed per capita dues to support this project at the outset. And John used the word collaboration, and it is, from its initial inception, deeply collaborative. There are countless people who were involved in taking Jim's vision and making it work. A number of interviewers before John, who Paul Kelso and Greg Zirin and Merle Davis, who went out in the field and went to communities, made initial contacts, and gradually worked their way, in a sense, into the community to find the voices that hadn't been heard. Mm-hmm. And that was so important.
And Shelton, you said unique. Do you mean unique for Iowa, unique for the nation?
Well, there are some aspects of it that John and I think would both agree are unique for the nation. This is a huge collection. There are 1,200 or so individual interviews, some of which run as much as 8 hours. And these are interviews that were done with great care and with great professionalism. They were interviews that touched literally every town and city in the state and every realm of work and labor union activity. So it's inclusive in a way that I don't know of another collection in the country that has that character. And it also has a rank and file dimension. I mean, there are a lot of interviews around the country with leaders, and
right,
that's fine. We need to hear the voices of leaders. But this is a collection, because of its scope, that builds literally, as you were saying, from the bottom up.
Right, right. And it reminds me, in listening to some of the things that we'll hear a little bit later in the hour, sort of a Studs Terkel approach, little guy in quotes, because these are just people who don't have the levers of power in their hands, right? But very important to our labor history. Often.
Well, and I would say, and I think maybe this is what Jichelle is going to say, is that they remind us that when workers come together, they can have the levers of power in their hands.
That's collectively.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, it's not just people sitting out there in their homes and workplaces, but it's people organizing to make a difference in their communities.
Great distinction.
And ordinary people doing this.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Let's hear some from this project. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the Iowa Labor History Oral Project. My guests, Shelton Stromquist, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa, John McCurley, Oral and Public Historian at the Iowa Labor Center, located at the University of Iowa. And let's tackle Don Harris is someone we want to talk about. John, tell us about Don Harris. This is interesting in that his formative years were during the Great Depression, I believe.
Right. So Don Harris is a great unknown labor leader of Iowa history. Born in North Dakota, grew up in mostly in Des Moines, organized with young people in Des Moines during the Great Depression, early Great Depression, at Rollins Hosiery Mill in Des Moines, and organizing before, you'll hear him say the NRA, the National Recovery Act. So that these sort of
don't
first,
confuse it.
Right, exactly. These early efforts by the federal government to try to deal with the Great Depression. Well, here on the ground, workers like Don Harris and other young men and women in Des Moines are trying to solve their own problems by organizing.
Okay, here's Don Harris, CIO organizer. Let's hear his voice.
Well, what was your first work experience? Where did you get into it?
Well, the first job I had outside of working around on farms and so on was at Rollins Hosiery Mill.
Now, this is about 1930?
1930 when I started working there.
We've got the Depression.
It was during the Depression, things were terrible. We was only making starvation wages, working 72 hours a week, 6 12-hour nights, no vacations with pay, no fringe benefits whatsoever.
I was just going to ask you what it was that gave you religion in terms of the unions and why you became a union man. I think you've started to answer my question there, didn't you? With the conditions.
Well, that's right. We had, of course, you could be fired at the whim of the boss. We had no benefits, no protection. They come around and say, due to the present economic situations, we find it necessary to cut your wages 10%. Well, that was it. Your wages were cut 10%. You didn't have any recourse. Mm-hmm. And so when Roosevelt was elected and the NRA was promulgated with its famous Section 7A, the right of the workers to organize and bargain collectively, we jumped at it.
Okay, Don Harris, union organizer, grew up in Des Moines. That gives us, Shelton, a real sense of where we've come in the last, 100 years or so in terms of workers' rights. You have to ask, after hearing a clip like that, where would we be without the advances made by workers collecting, organizing together and pushing for what would be just acceptable working rights, not to be fired on the spot, for instance, for no reason.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Harris is really emblematic in many ways of this generation of young people who were growing up in the Depression and facing really tough conditions. And one of the wonderful things about his interview, this is a part of it, but the larger interview, is that he captures that sense of excitement and enthusiasm as these young people. I mean, these were people in their 20s,
yeah,
who would pool their money for gas and run up to Charles City or Mason City or Cherokee or wherever and pitch in to help the organizing that was going on there, and they'd fire off leaflets and they'd stay up all night building this organization that suddenly had such inspiration behind it. You know, the NRA, the Section 7A that he talked about, the labor movement often. Labor activists translated it into a simple phrase: "The president wants you to join a union," which wasn't exactly Roosevelt's intent,
right?
But that was the meaning that they took from Section 7A, and it opened a door to a wave of organizing in Iowa and around the country that was really powerful.
Mm-hmm. So Don Harris, an organizer, when would he have been an organizer, John?
Well, so he goes on from working here in Des Moines. You know, he's so successful here in Des Moines that he gets picked up by the national CIO. And so he works as an organizer for the Packing House Workers Organizing Committee. And so he goes around the Midwest. And then he ultimately he works for the United Electrical Workers and the Farm Equipment Workers in the 40s and the 50s. Oh, and he goes off to World War II and he's a bomber pilot. And
by the way,
in the 40s, by the way, you know, comes back into the labor movement. And then he ends his career, I believe, working for the United Auto Workers. So, you know, he has this huge expanse in the middle of the 20th century.
Okay, let's examine before the break one more of these fascinating figures in Iowa's labor history as we trace it this hour with John McCurley of the Iowa Labor Center and Shelton Stromquist, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Iowa. I see Anne May Weems. This is a woman born in Waterloo, a labor and civil rights activist in the 1950s. Tell us about her.
Anne May Weems, her father's from Mississippi, like, you know, so many Black Iowans of her generation. Her family moves into Waterloo, and then, you know, she struggles in this community that, you know, on the one hand has this burgeoning Black community that's struggling to assert its rights in a frankly white supremacist context. And at the same time, you know, finds allies within the context of the United Packing House Workers. And so that's what she's describing here, is the work of the United Packing House Workers, or UPWA Local 46, in Waterloo, and its work with the NAACP to advance the interests both of workers and of Black people in the city.
Okay, this is the voice of Anna May Weems from the Iowa Labor History Oral Project.
What'd you do when you started to rest?
First thing, Charles Pearson was saying to us,
who's Charles Pearson?
He was a divisional steward. And he said, he came to a meeting of NAACP. He said that we need someone to take a test because they want to put somebody in the plant. And they said, will you take the test? I said, yeah, I'll take the test, but just so Black people get in there. He said, okay, well, come take the test and we can get people hired, because they said Blacks cannot work in there. So I came down, took the test, and I passed it. Just a test asking questions, some silly questions, not pertaining to the work. And so they said, then you can start work Monday. I didn't want to work at a packing house. You know, I was scared of hogs and all that. And so Charles told him, he said, she passed, that means that, no, she's got to go in. So he said, well, you got to go in. He said, I'm going to be there for a while. You'll be out of there. So they put me right away into wet sausage. And down in the basement, dirty, wet, dry. It was very undesirable, hoping I'd quit. And I was a Lincoln Tire. Mm-hmm. And then sometime they would take the viscings and cut them. That way the stuff fly all over me, you know, just a lot of harassment. But then the union came down there and got on them about that.
They kept moving you around.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't you moving, it was a company moving.
Company. It was Charles Pearson keeping after me because they were trying to make me quit, you know, put me in those bad openings.
Okay, Anna May Weems, a labor and civil rights activist in the 1950s, talking about her time, remembrances of working at the Rath Packing Company, now defunct, was based in Waterloo. So we're talking about packing. I hate to phrase it this way. Unpack a little bit of what we heard in that comment, because it's fascinating. I'm not sure I understood everything. So the wet sausage. So they were right, putting her in the parts of the Rath Packing plant that were just horrible.
Right. And this was, you know, this was a typical experience for Black workers, men and women, but mm-hmm. especially women, to be put into the dirtiest and the most repulsive workplaces imaginable. And this, you want to work in the factory, this is where you work. And it was largely women and, in some plants, predominantly Black women who got these jobs. So that was tough to begin with. But it also, I mean, I think what's also important here is that in a place like Rath Packing or in other plants where Black workers went to work, they were coming up against racism that was built into the structure of employment, right? Mm-hmm. There were only certain jobs that Blacks would be assigned. But they were also coming up against, let's face it, a culture of white privilege that, however unprivileged it might have seemed, white workers had traditionally laid claim to. And so the union became a very important vehicle for not only challenging the hiring structure and the distribution of jobs that the plant was offering, but also the day-to-day interaction of black and white workers. And, you know, I have to say, a union like the UPWA had a really important and really admirable record of challenging that latent culture of white supremacy among its own members and pushing back and saying, you know, this is not what our union subscribes to. You want to be a member of the union? You have to recognize that we're all in this together, black and white.
John McCurley.
Well, and Waterloo, this is one of those places where Iowa's important, I think, is that here in Waterloo, these workers in Local 46, they were part of helping to forge that culture within the union. So, you know, and it's an international union. There's UPWA locals in Canada as well as all across the United States. And Waterloo is you know, even though the union runs out of Chicago, Waterloo was a very important player in shaping that culture.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what activists like Anna Mae Weems and others like her accomplished in specifics in terms of working for a place like Rath Packing in Waterloo or other places when it came to black Americans working alongside white Americans. What was not allowed after as these unions became successful in what they were pressing for?
Well, I mean, there had to be open hiring and open access to jobs that became open in which color was not a bar, in which black workers had the same rights as white workers as union members to lay claim to those jobs. But part of it was also the struggles that were going on outside of the factory and outside of the union hall. And that is struggles over desegregation of facilities, struggles over housing, struggles over day-to-day living conditions in the communities where black and white workers found themselves. And unions had played an important leadership role. There are just some wonderful stories in this.
You've got a quick one. We've got a break in about a minute. Have you got a quick one?
Well, there's again, it's from Waterloo, a guy named Edwin Hollins who worked in the John Deere factory and who was dying from the conditions in the plant, basically hired on as a teamster. He and his teamster buddies, all the rest white, were in caravan in Savannah, Illinois, went into the lunch counter to get something to eat. And the lunch counter refused to serve Edwin Hollins, who was black. And his Teamster buddies looked around and said, "What do you mean you're not going to serve him?" And they said, "Well, it's not local practice here for us to serve black people in our restaurant." And the guy said, "Well, you know, it better become local practice right now. How would you like these guys to drive their rigs into your restaurant?" and the manager said, "Okay, all right, we'll
How
serve
many
you.
Sandwiches do you want?"
Yeah, right, exactly.
Shelton Stromquist with his professor of history emeritus at the University of Iowa, John McCurley of the Iowa Labor Center. We'll be back in just a minute. This is a fascinating travel back in time to find out how we got to where we are in terms of labor history. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're traveling back through time on a tour of a history of Iowa, which is, as was pointed out in the first half hour, has been until recent decades often ignored. Labor, working class history, told from the bottom up, how organized labor formed in our state, in our nation. Our tour guides on this tour from the past into the present, John McCurley, oral and public historian at the Iowa Labor Center at the University of Iowa, Shelton Stromquist, professor emeritus at the University of Iowa. Really fascinating. If you have a story of labor activism to share, 1-866-780-9100, or of course a question for our guests, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's listen to some more voices that are collected by the Iowa Labor History Oral Project, goes by the acronym ILHOP. Let's jump right into the teachers' labor movement, and we'll be introduced to a woman named Janet Fife LaFrance. John, tell us about her and what she represents in this oral history.
Well, so just really quickly, it's important to note that the workers we've been talking about were able to organize legally under federal law, which governs private sector employment. Well, in Iowa, like many states, the public sector workers, including teachers, were excluded from that. And it's here in the late 1960s, early 1970s in Iowa and in many places across the United States when public sector workers are organizing in an effort to get those same kinds of rights. And so Janet here is a teacher in Keokuk in 1970 when negotiations, informal, outside the law negotiations between the school board and teachers are breaking down. And she's describing how she and her other fellow teachers have coming together in order to try to assert their own rights.
The voice of Janet Fife LaFrance.
And I can recall going and being a support to the negotiations team, mm-hmm. along with many, many other educators. And it would be 3 a.m., and we would all stumble out to our cars, drive home, and get up at 6 o'clock the next morning so we could meet in class so that we would not miss a day. But we were there to support our negotiating team. And this went on and on and on.
So there was an early sense of the stakes that were involved?
Yes, yes, yes. I have to say the educators really did support each other because that group of people that would stay on and on and on so late at night was getting larger too.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, and do you remember what the initial how the teachers saw those stakes? What were the real concerns that were driving teachers to go to those meetings, to stay to those late hours?
Well, I think the biggest thing would be the fact that they weren't treating us as if we were people, that we had concerns about our future, our profession. To them, we were just another employee that was to punch in on a time clock and just work through the production line. We're not working with widgets. We're working with human minds.
Wow. We're not working with widgets. We're working with human minds. Well, what powerful words from Janet Fife LaFrance in this oral history interview given a teacher negotiated before the Keokuk teacher strike. So acquaint us with the early 1970s and what it led to, John. How did this climax?
Okay, so these negotiations, as I say, they're taking place outside the law, and this is in large part because boards, you know, even by the 1970s, had recognized that there was some benefit to talking to their employees and negotiating, even before there was a state law to do this. What that meant, however, was that since it was outside the law, that boards held all the cards, and so you could go through negotiations, the board could look at the results of the negotiations and go, we don't like what you want, so we're just going to impose our own solution, right? And that's what tried to happen here in Keokuk. But what the teachers decided was that they weren't going to take the really radical negative proposals that the board was trying to foist on them, and they decided to take the not entirely unprecedented step, because there had been teacher strikes back in the 20s, but to strike. And it was a dramatic episode where the teacher leaders are hauled off to jail for leading this legal strike, which then breaks the board's resolve, because you know they think, oh my goodness, you know what have we done, and the community sweeps in on the side of the teachers, and then the board ends up sending negotiators into the jail and negotiating a contract through the middle of the night, and all of this leads to ultimately what will become in 1974 the Public Employment Relations Act in Iowa, which establishes for the first time the statewide right of public sector workers to join and form unions.
Mm, interesting. Let's hear another voice from the Iowa Labor History Oral Project with some context from John McCurley and Shelton Stromquist, our guests today. I think Mario Ruiz Ronquillo, we're coming up into contemporary times. This gentleman, born in 1974, outside of the U.S. in New Mexico, one of 10 kids, but he found his way to Iowa, right? How?
Right. Well, that's a question that, well, he follows his siblings. So we've done interviews with this recent group of immigrant and refugee workers, and quite frankly, one of the questions you don't ask in order to protect your interviewees in these circumstances is exactly how you came here.
Okay.
And so none of that information is in the interviews for the protection of our interviewees. In Mario's case, he migrates to the United States, goes to Beardstown, Illinois. Joins the union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and rises up through the ranks as a steward and as a translator, and is successful, so successful that he ends up becoming an organizer with the United Food and Commercial Workers out of Davenport, where he does organizing with immigrant workers all across the state. And here he's describing the kinds of profound risks that he found in a packing plant out in western Illinois.
Mario Ruiz Ronquillo.
Mostly of the workers that were working in this plant were from Guatemala. And, the fear, I saw it right firsthand, the fear that they have to talk to the union. It was amazing, They would come out and tell you, yeah, I'm here, it's me, but I really don't want to talk to you. It's not that I don't like you. It's just I can't talk to you. It's gonna cost me my job. And me coming out of a union plant where you could, tell your supervisor what your issue was, and get it solved.
Okay, Mario Ruiz Ronquillo, a packing house worker and union representative who immigrated from Mexico. What makes this period unique? And to hear, too, the comment is, we hear, real risk in joining a union, even though it's more contemporary times in the late 20th century, don't we, Sheldon?
Absolutely. Every generation of workers, there's an old labor film called The Inheritance. And the phrase in that film that sticks in my mind is every generation's got to do it again, which essentially means that you're always, in one sense, at square one. And particularly in a period like ours, where protections for union workers have been rolled back, where the NLRB is not functioning in the way it was intended to function to protect workers' rights to organize, workers like the one we just heard, in order to step forward and say, yeah, I want to organize a union, have to understand that they're doing it without the protection that workers of previous generations had come to believe they had. And so those risks are real. It's a risk to the support of their families, their wages, the protections at the workplace, and in some cases, physical harm that can come from organizing.
And just to add one thing to that, one of the amazing things about ILHOP is that because of its breadth, we have multiple generations of workers represented. And so some of the earliest interviewees were people who were either themselves or their parents had been members of Southern and Eastern European immigrants during the early part of the 20th century, who in many ways are very much like many of the recent immigrants in the United States today, in the sense that they come from agrarian backgrounds, going into industrial settings, and quite frankly subject to a racist nativist response. And again, in this case, we're not used to thinking about Southern and Eastern Europeans as people who are going to be subject to racism, but in the early 20th century, they very much were.
Okay. Hearing voices from the Iowa Labor History Oral Project. You can find out more at iowalaborhistory.org. Sheldon Stromquist, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
There were just a couple of things that came up in these last two clips,
yes,
that I think we want to just linger over a little bit. One was the teacher who spoke about it all being about dignity and respect.
Mm-hmm.
When you drill down in workers' motivations to take these risks that we've been talking about, it's not just about wages. It is about wages. It's not just about working conditions. It's also about being treated with respect. And that is, in some sense, the emotional core of what really brings people to take these kinds of risks. There's a wonderful story in the Ilhop interviews with a guy who was a packing house worker in the 1930s at Tobin Packing in Fort Dodge. His name is Richard Linder. And he said, you know, we worked 10, 12 hours a day. We'd stand on the line for 4 or 5 hours. You'd eventually have to go to the bathroom, right? And so he went to his supervisor and he said, you know, I need a bathroom break. And the guy turned to him and he said, what'd you do when you were a baby? The implication of that was pretty clear.
Yeah.
And he said, that's what made a union man out of me.
We have one more bit of tape to hear. Joe John Zahorek, an iron worker who was born in Cedar Rapids in the early 1980s. John, tell us about him before you hear his voice.
So Joe is a fourth generation iron worker. According to family lore, the great grandfather had worked on the base of the Statue of Liberty before heading west. One of the interesting things about Joe too is that when he got interested in his grandfather's story in particular, and went to his father and said, you know, hey, can you tell me stories? And he said, and his father said, well, I can do one better. And he handed him his Ilhop interview that had been done with his grandfather. So he's a great example of someone who was able to experience Ilhop and his own ancestry that way.
Okay, iron worker and labor union activist, Joe John Zahorek. Let's hear him.
The sort of quality of life in Lisbon, being a small town, you know, just sort of diminishing. People would be out of work more. You'd see a lot more broken down cars. And you know it's because these plants were, you know, going non-union and wages were dropping and density was dropping. And the correlation is pretty strong, you know, with the timelines that you can see. See the quality of life starting to drop as density starts to drop. And things have sort of leveled out, I suppose, but they've never really gotten better. They've never got back to what it was like when I was a kid. But, so when I finished school, I approached my uncle and said, because like I said, he was business manager at the time, I approached him and said, you know, I wanna be an ironworker. What can I do? You know, what do I do with the application? And he said, no, your dad said you're not gonna be. So I ended up going to Kirkwood for a couple of years, racked up some debt and didn't really do much with schooling, was delivering pizzas, you know, and eventually I approached my dad and I said, look, I just want the chance to at least do the apprenticeship since everyone else has, you know, let me at least do that. And so eventually he agreed to it and I came back and filled out my application and got in. I knew within the first couple weeks really that it was sort of, I'd found what I wanted to do.
Fourth generation iron worker Joe Zahorek describing growing up in Lisbon, Iowa in the 80s and 90s, and also describing why he chose to pursue a union apprenticeship. In the last 5 minutes, John McCurley and Shelton Stromquist, let's reflect a little bit on this history and its relevance for today. Let me throw that question out there, big and broad as it is. What is its relevance for today? Well, what benefit is it to remember our labor history, especially here in Iowa?
Well, again, I think it goes back to one of the most important lessons that these interviews convey, and that is that people make a difference in their own lives and the lives of their communities by what they do, what they undertake, the risks they're willing to endure. You know, and if we go back a century or more into the 19th century even, we encounter Iowa workers in very adverse times. You know, this is not the first period of adversity that American workers have faced. In very adverse times, getting together, holding meetings, sometimes in secret, sometimes in public, and finally at some point saying, you know, we've got to step forward and build this union. And so in the Knights of Labor, through the American Federation of Labor, eventually through the CIO in the 1930s, and now today, especially in the public sector that John has done so much to document, we see this kind of renewed spirit that, you know, we can make a difference here.
Okay, talking about the modern era, Dirk, one of our listeners, would be interested to know if the current governor and her party have done what he asks is more than other modern Iowa leaders to limit the powers of labor, or have there been more extreme cases, asks Dirk, in the past. Place the current time in context. What can you say about that, John?
Well, the interesting thing I think that brings up is that in the case of Iowa, you've had, and I think this is because of what we've been talking about, the ways that so for example, you know, if you've got a town of 20,000 or 10,000, and you have 20,000 of those workers organized in a factory, you know, plus say, you know, several hundred teachers, that's a pretty significant group. And what that has meant traditionally is that both political parties had, you know, for a very long time in Iowa history, had to look very seriously at labor. And so what that meant was that you had the creation of a progressive wing within the Republican Party that lasted several decades in Iowa and has only recently really begun to disappear. And again, I think you can trace that back to the organizing power of workers in the state.
Yeah, and very quickly before we have to go, I guess the big question for a lot of listeners would be, why the backlash against labor? Does labor overreach sometimes in its desires to have improving conditions? Why when we have periods of the lack of support, why does organized labor fall back and lose some of the hard fought gains?
Well, I don't think it's for lack of support among would-be union members. Approval ratings for unions is high in the United States, well above 50%. What we've seen is systematic attacks on the ability of unions to continue to function in the way they had come to function after the 1930s. And, you know, union densities have fallen. By union density, I mean the proportion of workers organized in unions in the private sector have fallen from 35% in the U.S. to something like 7 to 8%. Now, the public sector, and I think this is what's really important about this, the union densities are higher. They're in the 30 to 40% range. And so where are we seeing the attacks on labor these days? In Iowa, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and other states, it's against the public sector because that's become the kind of bedrock of strength that the labor movement has. But, you know, we've had times before where labor has fought back from very difficult situations and been able to rebuild itself.
Does this intimate look at the history of labor in Iowa and in the nation going back generations tell us anything about what is to come? Is it like a pendulum swinging back and forth, or is it not that simple? I don't imagine it's that simple, but comment, please.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't subscribe to the pendulum theory, but I do think that what happens is that workers, you know, what happens is that workers experience bad conditions in their workplace, and each generation, as Shell said, and generation after generation, some are more successful than others, but they through that experience of work and that recognition that that they have interests as workers that are distinct, that pulls them together, and they build movements, sometimes very small ones and sometimes really big ones.
And does this come typically at a time of growing, and we do have historic levels of income inequality, right?
Well, income inequality is clearly a driver, and you can hardly think of a period of higher income inequality than the Great Depression. But the other thing I would mention is that politics ultimately does matter. And Franklin Roosevelt, willingness to support legislation that would, at a minimum, guarantee workers the right to vote freely, to have a union or not have a union, made a huge difference in the 1930s with the Wagner Act and in enabling workers to begin to have some protection of their rights at the workplace to organize. Now, we're back in a situation where the politics has not gone labor's way. And it's time, you know, in many ways, for the labor movement to gear itself up for another campaign to rebuild the fabric of protections, legal protections, that are so necessary for them to be able to effectively organize.
Let's, on the way out, remind our listeners how they can find out more about this project, going to iowalaborhistory.org. And what will people find there, John?
They'll find a description of the exhibit. Well, they'll find all sorts of information about the Iowa Labor History Society, but also about the exhibit, which I should mention was made possible through funds in part through Humanities Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And let me just quickly add that John has been working on a digitized index to these 1,200 interviews that within a fairly short space of time is going to provide people around the state access to the raw material that we've been talking about.
Okay. Find out more at iowalaborhistory.org. I want to thank our guests this hour, Shelton Stromquist, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa, John McCurley, Oral and Public Historian at the Iowa Labor Center at the University of Iowa as well. John and Shelton, it's been a fascinating hour giving context to our present day. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben. It's been nice.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Shirley Wong, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.